fine. What they can't do, what they never learn to do, is to socialize successfully. Cats and other social mammals such as rats will, if seriously missing out on play, have an inability to clearly delineate friend from foe, miscue on social signaling, and either act excessively aggressive or retreat and not engage in more normal social patterns. In the give and take of mock combat, the cats are learning what Daniel Goleman calls emotional intelligence, the ability to perceive others' emotional state and to adopt an appropriate response. I believe that play teaches young animals to make sound judgments, Bob Fagan told me that day in Alaska. For instance, play fighting may let a bear learn when it can trust another bear and, if things get too violent, when it needs to defend itself or flee. Play allows pretend rehearsal for the challenges and ambiguities of life, a rehearsal in which life and death are not at stake. Play lets animals learn about their environment and the rules of engagement with friend and foe. Playful interaction allows a penalty-free rehearsal of the normal give-and-take necessary in social groups. In the animal world, it is common to see a kitten, puppy, or cub playfully lunge and bite at its mother. This pouncing practice may serve them well later in a fight or hunt, but the more important lesson may be how to show off for siblings or learn just how much abuse mom can take before she freaks out. In humans, verbal jousting may take the place of physical rough-and-tumble play. Kids at play can learn the difference between friendly teasing and mean-spirited taunting as they explore the boundaries between those two, and learn how to make up when the boundary is crossed. Adults at cocktail parties learn similar social guidelines about how to get along with others, or how to seem to. The brain on play. Animals that play a lot quickly learn how to navigate their world and adapt to it. In short, they are smarter. Neuroscientist Sergio Pellis of the University of Lethbridge in Canada and neuroscientist Andrew Iwaniuk and biologist John Nelson of Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, reported that there is a strong positive link between brain size and playfulness for mammals in general. For their study, which was the most extensive quantitative comparative study of juvenile play ever published, they measured brain size and tabulated play behavior in 15 species of mammals that ranged from dogs to dolphins. They found that when they made allowances for differing body size, the species with larger brains, compared with body size, played a lot, and the species with smaller brains played less. Another renowned senior play researcher, Yok Pong Sep, has shown that active play selectively stimulates brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which stimulates nerve growth in the amygdala, where emotions get processed, and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, where executive decisions are processed. John Byers, an animal play scholar interested in the evolution of play behavior, has undertaken a detailed analysis of brain size correlated with the degree of playfulness and the relative rung of the evolutionary ladder to which the player belongs. He discovered something. The amount of play is correlated to the development of the brain's frontal cortex, which is the important brain region responsible for much of what we call cognition, discriminating relevant from irrelevant information, monitoring and organizing our own thoughts and feelings, and planning for the future. In addition, the period of maximum play in each species is tied to the rate and size of growth of the cerebellum. This part of the brain lies in back of and below the main hemispheres, and contains more neurons than the whole rest of the brain. Its functions and connections were once thought to be primarily for coordination and motor control. But through new brain imaging techniques, researchers are finding that the cerebellum is responsible for key cognitive functions such as attention, language processing, sensing musical rhythm, and more. Byers speculates that during play, the brain is making sense of itself through simulation and testing. Play activity is actually helping sculpt the brain. In play, most of the time we are able to try out things without threatening our physical and emotional well-being. We are safe precisely because we are just playing. For humans, creating such simulations of life may be play's most valuable benefit. In play, we can imagine and experience situations we have never encountered before and learn from them. We can create possibilities that have never existed but may in the future. We make new cognitive connections that find their way into our everyday lives. We can learn lessons and skills without being directly at risk. So how do we create these simulations? Through watching and engaging in sports, physical activities, books, storytelling, art, movies, and much, much more. By living through Rick and Ilsa's doomed romance in Casablanca, we learn a little bit about love and how to live our lives with honor and a sense of irony when love is lost. When we really get into following the victories and defeats of a favorite football team, we learn about perseverance and how to argue with our friends, about who is the best quarterback, for instance, in a constructive way. When we experience a new physical challenge, like learning to ski, we may find that the things we learn on the slopes, like avoiding falling by keeping our weight forward and committing to the turn, may come to mind during business negotiations as important reminders to press forward and commit to the deal, or fail. On the basis of highly technical research and his speculations stemming from it, the Nobel laureate and neuroscientist Gerald Edelman has created a theory about how new information is functionally integrated into the brain. When I correlate his opinions with my observations on how play may craft the developing brain, what he says makes good sense to me. Edelman describes how our perceptual experiences are coded within the brain in scattered maps, each of which is a complex network of interconnected neurons. For instance, the many different shapes and sizes of trees that exist in the world are encoded into a common map that encodes what tree-ness is, allowing us to recognize a tree even when we have never seen its particular kind before. In this way, the brain achieves a rich and flexible series of maps that permit the recognition of innumerable sorts of objects, sounds, colors, social settings, and so on. The perceptual generalizations arising from these maps are not static. They flex and change. They also have emotional connotations. We find our way in the world by navigating this huge and organically growing cartography of life. The vitality of these maps depends on the active and incessant orchestration of countless details. It seems likely that this orchestration happens most fully through play. The act of pretend playing, for example, is a rich stew of mixed perceptions. Imagine a 3-year-old sitting on the floor, playing with a stuffed animal, talking to it in various voices. This child is forming neural connections that make more and more sense as they are added to the growing body of stored, mapped information. The very rich connections among the brain's maps are reciprocal and may involve millions of fibers. My sense of these interconnecting and dynamic maps is that they are most effectively enriched and shaped by the states of play. Play's process of capturing a pretend narrative and combining it with the reality of one's experience in a playful setting is, at least in childhood, how we develop our major personal understanding of how the world works. We do so initially by imagining possibilities, simulating what might be, and then testing this against what actually is. Though this may seem to be a primarily childish trait, close examination of adult internal narratives, our stream of consciousness, reveals something similar. Our adult imaginations are also continually active, predicting the future and examining the consequences of our behavior before it takes place. Just as in children, adult streams of consciousness are enriched through the simulations of childlike imaginative play. We all daydream about events in our future, even if we are not consciously aware of it. These thoughts leave an imprint on our brains. Someone might not even notice as they fantasize about what kind of house they would like to live in, or whom they would like to marry. But the brain is constructing a working profile of a future house or future spouse. Psychoanalyst Ethel Persson writes that, through therapy, one client discovered that much of his effectiveness in business came from his repeated imaginings of possible interactions that he might have on a particular issue. By the time he actually had the conversation, he was usually pretty well prepared for any contingency. The genius of play is that, in playing, we create imaginative new cognitive combinations. And in creating those novel combinations, we find what works. One biologist who studied river otters decided to train some of them to swim through a hoop by offering a food reward for completing the task. Shortly after the otters learned to do this, the animals started introducing their own twists to the task. They swam through the hoop backward and waited to see if they got a reward. They swam through and then turned around and swam back through the other way. They swam halfway through and stopped. After each variation, they waited expectantly to see if this version of the task would earn a reward or not. Through their behavior, the otters were testing the system. They were learning the rules of the game, the rules that govern their world. This was not a thought-out strategy. Otters are naturally extremely playful and are always attracted to new and interesting things. Their natural search for novelty and avoidance of boredom leads them to try the task a number of different ways. By having fun and mixing it up, the otters were learning far more about the way their world works than if they had simply performed the initial task flawlessly. It's a lesson we all could learn. The biologist ruefully noted that he had been trying for years to get his graduate students to use such playful investigation rather than rote learning and mechanical thinking in their research. Landmark research done in the 1960s at UC Berkeley by Marion Diamond also points to the essential role of play in brain development. One warm winter day, I went to visit Diamond, a charming and gracious woman who had also been a groundbreaking neuroscientist for nearly a half century. She was uncovering the secrets of neurological development when few other women were top scientists, much less neuroscientists. Diamond's name isn't known widely outside scientific circles, but her work is familiar to every parent. In the early 1960s, Diamond and her colleagues conducted the landmark experiments showing not only that rats raised in an enriched environment became smarter, but their brains were larger and more complex, with a thicker and more developed cortex. The gray matter, where the brain's real data processing takes place. The idea quickly took hold in the popular imagination. If babies were raised in an enriched nursery with lots of colorful murals and mobiles, they would also experience supercharged brain development. What Diamond told me about her experiments, though, brought to light an important distinction between her work and its interpretation in popular culture. The rats that grew bigger, more complex brains, and became smarter weren't just exposed to a greater variety of stimuli. They weren't merely given more colorful surroundings and more interesting sounds. The secret to brain growth for the rats in the original experiments was that they played with an ever-changing variety of rat toys and socialized with other rats. The combination of toys and friends was established early on as vital to qualifying the environment as enriched, Diamond said. Play was the true key for the rats' brain development. They tussled and chewed, wrestled with each other, explored and interacted with the toys. They investigated and invited other rats to play. Those were active things they did. The rats were not passively soaking up their interesting surroundings. For human babies, the lesson should be not so much that babies should be provided with bright, colorful, interesting nurseries, although this can't hurt. The lesson should be that it is crucial to provide babies and young children with the chance to play and socialize. Toys and tots, play and parental interaction, to help them reach their full potential. Merely changing the surroundings or offering varied challenges was not enough to get dramatic brain development, Diamond found. In one series of experiments, rats were tasked with finding their way through various mazes to find reward. This solitary, non-play activity resulted in neural growth in only one area of the brain, as opposed to the whole brain growth that play provided. I think that part of the confusion on the part of parents and pundits may have arisen from the term enrichment, which sounds less like a play activity than an ingredient you can add to the child-raising stew, and by the lack of discussion of the play aspects of the experiments. Diamond says she still finds the term enrichment fitting for what they were doing, but she acknowledges that she avoided discussing play or toys when describing the experiments. Back in the early 1960s, women had to struggle to be taken seriously as scientists, Diamond said. I was already seen as the silly woman who was watching rats play, so I did avoid the words toys and play. Diamond's experiments are merely among the most well-established research findings showing that play is crucial to healthy brain development. What is the link between neural growth and play? Why do play activities seem to go hand in hand with brain development? What difference does play make? The truth is that play seems to be one of the most advanced methods nature has invented to allow a complex brain to create itself. Why do I say this? Consider the fact that there is no exact blueprint for creating the brain. The information encoded in our DNA is far too sparse to define exactly how all the neurons should connect up with each other. Instead, the brain wires itself up. It does this by creating far too many neurons, which in turn make far too many connections with other neurons throughout the brain. Following rules of interaction laid down in the DNA, the neurons send signals through the circuits, strengthening those that work and weakening or eliminating those that don't. This process continues throughout life and is a kind of neural evolution. After birth, Most neurons are already in place, but they continue to make new connections. The fittest connections, the ones that work best, are the ones that survive. It's survival of the fittest. REM sleep, or dreaming sleep, seems to be a critical part of this testing. Sleep and dreams appear to be organizers of higher brain function. While no one is certain yet about all the functions of sleep and dreams, researchers find that these activities seem to create a dynamic stabilization of the brain and improve memory throughout life. Studies have shown that people remember things better if they have a good night of sleep after learning something. We know that REM sleep is most frequent during the periods of most rapid brain development, and the theory is that, during development, sleep and dreams probably contribute to this testing and strengthening of brain circuits. Play, which is more prevalent during the periods of most rapid brain development after birth, childhood, seems to continue the process of neural evolution, taking it even one step farther. Play also promotes the creation of new connections that didn't exist before. New connections between neurons and between disparate brain centers. It is activated from and organizes what I call divinely superfluous neurons. These are neural connections that don't seem to have an immediate function, but when fired up by play are, in fact, essential to continued brain organization. In playing, we foster the creation of those new circuits and test them by running signals through them. Because play is a non-essential activity, this testing is done safely when survival is not at stake. Play seems to be a driving force helping to sculpt how the brain continues to grow and develop. In rats, at least, the same areas of the brainstem that initiate sleep initiate play behavior. Like sleep, play seems to dynamically stabilize body and social development in kids, as well as sustain these qualities in adults. I find it exciting to see parallels between these two major behaviors, sleep and play. It's reasonable to see them both as essential long-term organizers of brain development and adaptability. The drive to play. Play seems to be so important to our development and survival that the impulse to play has become a biological drive. Like our desires for food, sleep, or sex, the impulse to play is internally generated. All drives are not equal in strength. Our primary need is to survive from one day to the next. The strongest drives are for food and sleep. When we are in peril, play will disappear. But studies show that if they are well-fed, safe, and rested, all mammals will play spontaneously. As the philosopher Jeremy Bentham observed, our behavior is determined largely by pleasure or pain. We are rewarded for behavior that conforms to the dictates of the biological drives and punished for behavior that goes against them. We feel pain when we don't eat, and great pleasure when we are finally able to chow down. As the saying goes, hunger is the best sauce. A great night's sleep, especially after a string of sleepless nights, is one of the most satisfying, free pleasures available. As children, our reward for play is strong because we need it to help generate a rapidly developing brain. As adults, the brain is not developing as rapidly, and the play drive may not be as strong. So we can do well enough without play in the short term. Our work or other responsibilities often demand we set play aside, but when play is denied over the long term, our mood darkens. We lose our sense of optimism, and we become anhedonic, or incapable of feeling sustained pleasure. There is laboratory evidence that there is a play deficit, much like the well-documented sleep deficit. And just as a sleep deficit generates a need for extra rebound sleep to catch up, laboratory research shows that animals that are deprived of play will engage in rebound play when allowed to do so again. While we don't have statistical evidence that the same happens in humans, anecdotal evidence from parents and teachers, as well as data gathered in many adult play histories I've conducted, indicate that humans also feel a much more intense desire to play when they have gone a long time without it. The flip side of the play drive is what it does for us when engaged. From the same play histories, I believe we have anecdotal evidence that with enough play, the brain works better. We feel more optimistic and more creative. We revel in novelties, a new fashion, new car, a new joke. And through our embrace of the new, we are attracted to situations that test skills we do not need now, but may need in the future. We find ourselves saying, "I did it just for the heck of it, but it turned out to be good for me." In an unpredictable, changing world, what we learn from playing can be transferred into other novel contexts. We seek out a variety of new contingencies through play, allowing us to thrive anywhere in the world. The first steam engine was a toy. So were the first airplanes. Darwin got curious about evolution initially through collecting samples from the seaside and garden where he played as a kid. Throwing stones likely led to the first projectiles, and perhaps the first spear. Fireworks in China preceded the cannon. As I muse on this, I think that math likely came via play with numbers. Wind-up toys led to the development of clocks. When we are not up against life or death, trial and error brings out new stuff. We want to do this stuff not because we think that paper airplanes will lead to 747s. We do it because it's fun. And many years later, the 747 is born. Is the universe playful? I like to say that when you open your eyes to it, play is everywhere. And I mean that literally. Play may operate at all levels, from the smallest cellular interaction to the far reaches of the universe. Play can be seen as a key component of evolution itself. The part of evolution that gets the most attention is natural selection, which is often called the survival of the fittest. But there is another part of the process that is equally important, the generation of diversity. First, nature generates many different versions of organisms, mostly through gene mutation and gene recombination. And then the best are selected by nature to reproduce and pass on their genes. The creation of these oddities, which Darwin called sports, is a kind of play. They are non-essential creations outside of everyday norms. Their creation adds a flexibility to the biological system. Biologists have shown that when this genetic flexibility is large, evolution proceeds more quickly. If this variation is absent, evolution will cease. Nothing changes. Indeed, this sort of flexibility or play seems to be an essential part of any complex, self-organizing system. Without odd variations thrown in, systems proceed in lockstep fashion. On a cosmic scale, the formation of galaxies, stars, and solar systems was possible because of slight irregularities in the fabric of the universe that came into existence shortly after the Big Bang. Without these irregularities, the universe would be a homogeneous soup of energy. Play is the swing off the rhythm in music, the bounce in the ball, the dance that delivers us from the lockstep march of life. It is the meaningless moment that makes the day memorable and worthwhile. I believe we live in a playful universe. Though my sense of this comes from cosmology and biology, the Hindu tradition formalizes play as the ultimate creative source of reality. Lila, Sanskrit, is a concept meaning pastime, sport, or play. Lila is a way of describing all reality, including the cosmos, as the outcome of creative play by the divine absolute. Chapter 3. We are built for play. The sea squirt is an ugly creature. In its adult form, it has a tubular shape that resembles a sponge or worm, and in its larval form, it looks like a tadpole. Still, the sea squirt is one of our most ancient relatives. Its primitive nervous system makes it more closely related to humans than the sponges and corals it resembles. Scientists say a sea squirt tadpole approximates what an early human ancestor, the very first chordate, may have looked like some 550 million years ago. In this larval form, it has a primitive spinal cord and bundle of ganglia that act as a functional brain. This tiny brain helps it move selectively toward nutrients and away from harm. Like most oceanic creatures, juvenile sea squirts spend their time growing and exploring the sea. Once the sea squirt grows to adulthood, it attaches itself permanently to a rock or a boat's hull or pilings. It no longer needs to monitor the world as it did as a juvenile because the passing current provides enough nutrients for it to survive. Its life becomes purely passive. The adult sea squirt becomes the couch potato of the sea. In a surprisingly macabre twist, the sea squirt digests its own brain. Without a need to explore or find its sustenance, the creature devours its own cerebral ganglia. It's like something out of a Stephen King book. All work and no play makes sea squirt a brain-eating zombie. The sea squirt is an example of a basic principle of nature. Use it or lose it. If a capability is not being used, it becomes an extravagance that is jettisoned or fades away. Either we grow and develop, or we waste away. Most animals don't go to extreme measures like the sea squirt, but the pattern remains the same. Most animals grow new nerve connections extensively only during the juvenile period. The sea squirt stops moving, and many higher animals stop playing, and the brain stops growing. But not humans. The brain can keep developing long after we leave adolescence, and play promotes that growth. We are designed to be lifelong players, built to benefit from play at any age. The human animal is shaped by evolution to be the most flexible of all animals. As we play, we continue to change and adapt into old age. Understanding why many animals stop playing in adulthood and why humans don't helps us further understand the role play has in adult life. Playing the hand that's dealt. If play is so good, why do animals ever stop? I've shown how play is an essential part of the development process, which is why all young animals play a great deal. Play creates new neural connections and tests them. It creates an arena for social interaction and learning. It creates a low-risk format for finding and developing innate skills and talents. The fact is that play is not completely without cost. Play can be dangerous. Australian scientist Robert Harcourt showed in a study of seal pups that among the 26 that were killed by predators, 22 were killed while playing out of the protective range of their parents. While engaged in play, animals are not finding food or shelter. If adult animals do nothing but play, they won't be paying attention to their offspring, making them more vulnerable to predators. As you may recall, the fact that play has real costs is one of the main reasons that I knew that it must be important. If play is so pervasive in the animal world, despite its costs to the organism, there must be a very strong reason for its existence. There must be a benefit that is even greater than the cost. The great benefits of play, as I've said, are the ability to become smarter, to learn more about the world than genes alone could teach, to adapt to a changing world. These benefits are most effective as the brain is growing more rapidly during the juvenile period. Once this period ends and development slows, for some animals, the costs begin to outweigh the benefits. In life's poker game, animals are dealt their genetic hand. They exchange a few cards during development, and then it's time to play their hand and see if they win or lose. This basic reproductive game can work well for organisms that reproduce once and die. They grow and learn. But at some point, school's out, and it's time to see if those learned skills allow them to survive and pass along their genes. This is the strategy of the salmon that hatch in streams, mature in the ocean, and then get one shot at surviving the merciless upriver marathon to spawn in the gravel stream beds where they were born. It's a primitive pattern usually associated with animals that have many offspring and rely on quantity rather than quality to have the best chance of reproductive success. Fish lay hundreds of eggs and leave, letting their offspring grow on their own and hoping that a few among these hundreds of newborns will grow to maturity. What is the best strategy, though, for organisms that reproduce several times during their life cycle and who have relatively few offspring during each reproductive cycle? Mammals, humans included, and birds, for instance, have few offspring and need to stick around to protect them in order to provide the best chance that some will survive to reproduce in turn. They also need to have multiple reproductive opportunities so that if the first batch of young ones doesn't survive, they will have another chance. This was a much more significant problem for humans in past history, before we were able to reduce our high infant mortality rate. They need to keep learning and growing, even when they reach their reproductive period, so that they have the chance to fail, learn, and then succeed. For these animals, nature alters the developmental program to allow extra playtime. Along with our opposable thumbs and massive prefrontal cortex, a singular characteristic of humans is that we stretch our juvenile period out longer than any other creature. Since one of the primary hallmarks of being juvenile is the desire and capacity to play, what would happen if our brains really keep juvenile elements such as growth and adaptability long past the period of our obvious prolonged childhoods? What if the maintenance of very useful juvenile qualities in the brain is the secret to success in many species, especially ours? The Labrador and the Wolf. The first time I came face to face with a wolf, I had the shocking realization that this was not a dog. Of course, that is something we all know logically, and yet they look so similar that we tend to think of them as being the same. I got to see wolves up close when I spent a week with C.J. Rogers, a researcher in New Mexico, whose Ph.D. in animal behavior I had helped supervise. I had concluded that she is to wolf studies what Jane Goodall is to the study of chimpanzees. Dogs, which have been selectively bred over millennia to interact with humans, see us as their pack masters, depend on us for sustenance, and gladly transfer their affections to us. So they greet us with a doggy version of a smile. They wag their tails, and often signal their readiness to play with a play bow. Even as they bark or whine at us, there is a comfortable sense of familiarity to this attention-getting display. In contrast to the complex singing in wolves, dogs sound off in response to territorial invasions or frustration, and as an attention-getting or emotional expression. Their play and their aggression are easily communicated to us. Wolves, even those that have been brought up around humans, are very different. They really don't need us for their survival, and thus don't spontaneously invite human-wolf play. Their regard for humans seems blank by comparison, neither friendly nor angry. Their social structure is complicated and hierarchical, and unless we participate as a member of the pack, as CJ does so skillfully, we are intruders. Yet as pups, wolves and dogs are like rambunctious cousins. Wolf pups and canine puppies behave so similarly that they seem virtually identical, distinguishable only by the various features we associate with a particular breed. Each starts life with a pugged nose muzzle, floppy ears, and strong attachment to their mothers. Wolves pass through predictable stages of development, which are characterized by particular kinds of behavior. As they grow, wolf pups and domestic dogs show an eagerness to play. For a brief period of development, wolf pups are compulsive retrievers. While a wolf pup is in this stage, its muzzle and ears are similar to those of an adult Labrador or Golden Retriever. If the domestic puppy is a Lab or Golden Retriever, its physiological and social development beyond this stage essentially stops. But for a wolf, this is just one stage in the path towards wolf adulthood. The wolves become pointers, and finally, as they mature, their muzzle is elongated and pointed, and their ears stand briskly upright. They have achieved wolf adulthood. At the same age, the Lab is certainly an adult Lab, fully capable of reproduction and no longer puppy size, but behaviorally still acts like a play-and-retriever stage wolf puppy. Certain breeds of dogs, German Shepherds, Huskies, Poodles, are more wolf-like than Labs. They are more loyal and territorial. But Golden Retrievers and Labs die of old age primarily still players and retrievers. Yes, wolves can still be playful as adults, but much of the time they are engaged in the business of pack formation and working out their specific status level. Once acquired, this role is much more fixed than the fluid relationships that result from domestic dog socialization. It is geared toward group survival by forming a rigid, hierarchical, but cooperative pack able to function as carnivores in the wild. Dogs are displaying an adaptive pattern called neoteny, from the Greek for stretch or extend, which describes the stretching of juvenile periods and sometimes the retention of juvenile characteristics into adulthood. This is a major theme in evolution. Since early development is a time when the nervous system is most plastic, an advantage that Neoteny bestows is extended openness to change and sustained curiosity, as well as the ability to readily incorporate new information. A seasoned alpha wolf may be a premier hunter, but will inevitably remain bound by narrower and more compulsive behaviors than a domestic dog. Like retrievers, humans are the youthful primates. We are the Labradors of the primate world. Just as Labrador and wolf pups look and act alike, chimpanzee babies look very much like human babies, with high, rounded foreheads and big eyes. As chimpanzees grow older, however, they acquire a sloped forehead and heavy brow ridges, a jaw that juts forward, and look very different than when they were young. They sort of resemble our Neanderthal ancestors. We modern humans remain baby faces all our lives, never losing the high forehead, rounded skull, and other characteristics typical of youth. We look more like chimpanzee babies than the chimp parents. Not only do we look more like chimpanzee infants than adults, we act more like them. As with the adult wolf, the adult chimp exhibits more compulsive, rigid, and purpose-driven behavior. Adult male chimpanzees have a strict dominance hierarchy. Don't play very much unless cajoled by a juvenile to participate, are reactive to strangers approaching their territory, and seem to like to fight more than play. Baby chimps exhibit the kind of playfulness that looks more human. This quality of retained immaturity goes deeper than our round faces and essentially hairless bodies. The nervous system of adult chimps, if damaged, has less room for repair. We, on the other hand, have much more capacity for new neuron growth, a characteristic of being forever young. A stroke patient in a modern rehabilitation center demonstrates that if the damage is not too severe or localized in a critical area, the brain has capacity to regain function through the creation of new neurons, neurogenesis, and new neural connections. Similarly damaged chimpanzees cannot recover. Lifelong youthfulness is not all fun and games, however. There is a trade-off in staying young. In many ways, wolf behavior is better adapted to survival in a difficult environment. Golden retrievers might not last a week in the wild. Dog behavior, on the other hand, is more suited to coexistence with humans. One set of behaviors is not really better than the other. Neoteny opens the door for greater adaptation, but brings with it certain costs. Neoteny tends to be more flexible, but vulnerable, while maturity is stronger, but more rigid or brittle. Neoteny is a boon to humans. It has allowed us to come down out of the trees and live anywhere on the planet. We are designed by nature and evolution to continue playing throughout life. Lifelong play is central to our continued well-being, adaptation, and social cohesiveness. Neoteny has fostered civilizations, the arts, and music. While Neoteny has its drawbacks, it's simply how we are built. The psychiatrist Erik Erikson sums it up beautifully. It is human to have a long childhood. It is civilized to have an even longer childhood. Long childhood makes a technical and mental virtuoso out of man, but it also leaves a lifelong residue of emotional immaturity in him. Of all animals, humans are the biggest players of all. We have stretched the juvenile development program to a minimum 15 years. Brain scans and behavioral analyses have demonstrated that in modern society, the executive centers of the brain continue to undergo changes into the 20s, a fact that our alcohol laws respect, but driver's licenses do not. But our brains don't stop evolving after our 20s. In an individual who is well-adjusted and safe, play very likely continues to prompt continued neurogenesis throughout our long lives. For example, studies of early dementia suggest that physical play forestalls mental decline by stimulating neurogenesis. Research on this subject is really in its early stages, but there are also a few studies that show a relationship between continued use of puzzles, playful exercise, games, and other forms of play, and resistance to neurodegenerative disease. Play in adulthood. How do adults play? The answer is not as obvious as it might seem. Many of the things we regard as play may, on closer inspection, have the qualities of work. And what to many people might seem like work may really be built on a foundation of play. A golf game might be the epitome of play, or it might be a part of a calculated, controlled effort to close a big sale. I live near Pebble Beach and have played on its famed golf course a few times. For most golfers, playing at Pebble is one of the highlights of their life, a special golf moment they may have dreamed of for years. Yet I've seen golfers who are ticked off when they tee off and feel no different after 18 holes. They are so miserable and angry that they spread their unhappiness to everyone around. These people are not playing. They are self-critical, competitive, perfectionistic, and preoccupied with the last double bogey. These emotions don't allow them to feel the playful, out of time, in the zone, doing it for its own sake sensation that accompanies joyful playfulness. Runner's World magazine once divided runners into four types: the exerciser, the competitor, the enthusiast, and the socializer. The exerciser is someone who runs primarily to lose weight, to stay in shape, to improve cardiovascular fitness. The competitor runs to improve race time, to beat others, to make a PB, personal best. Enthusiasts run to experience the joy of the day, to feel their muscles working and the air on their face. For the socializer, running is primarily an activity to bring people together for talking, which is the real fun. All four types are certainly running, but the internal experience can be very different. The truth is that the enthusiast and the socializer are more likely to be engaged in pure play, pursuing the activity for the joy it brings. And you could say that for the socializer, the source of joy is the talking, not the running itself. The other two may be running mostly in pursuit of goals, perhaps fast times or fitness, that can take away the joy from the experience and add stress to their lives. If exercisers or competitors feel lousy when they don't meet certain expectations they have for themselves, what they are doing is not really play. On the other hand, the thrill of competition may be a necessary and healthful part of the competitor's play. Sometimes running is play, and sometimes it is not. What is the difference between the two? It really depends on the emotions experienced by the runner. Play is a state of mind rather than an activity. Remember the definition of play: an absorbing, apparently purposeless activity that provides enjoyment and a suspension of self-consciousness and sense of time. It is also self-motivating and makes you want to do it again. We have to put ourselves in the proper emotional state in order to play, although an activity can also induce the emotional state of play. Neuroscientist Jaak Ponsepp, who extensively studied play in rats and other animals at Bowling Green University and now has a play research center at Washington State University, believes that play arises first in the human brainstem, where survival mechanisms such as respiration, consciousness, sleep, and dreams originate. This initial activation, which is inbuilt and hardwired, then connects to and activates pleasurable emotions that accompany the process of playing. Without this emotional linkage, what occurs is something other than play. Watching sports, sitcoms, opera, or an excellent drama on TV is usually a type of play, as is reading a novel. Think about how you feel walking out of a really good movie, bringing your mind back again to the everyday world, but retaining a changed perspective. One critic remembers walking out of Lawrence of Arabia and feeling that the sunlight looked different. This sense of coming back to the world shows that the movie was indeed play. So is reliving its scenes in your mind later. Hobbies like model airplane building, kite flying, or sewing are most often play. In fact, I would say that the impulse to create art is a result of the play impulse. Art and culture have long been seen as a sort of byproduct of human biology, something that just happens as we use our big, complex brains. But the newer thinking is that art and culture are something that the brain actively creates because it benefits us, something that arises out of the primitive and childlike drive to play. If we look at a life over time and observe the origins of many artistic expressions, they are rooted in early play behavior that gets encouraged by natural talent and richness of opportunity in the environment. Watch a 2-year-old who is drawn to music spontaneously dance to the beat of a summer band concert in the park. 15 years later, that kid may be a consummate pianist or just spend hours humming and strumming a guitar. But the draw to rhythm and music were kindled by spontaneous playfulness when the band started playing during that long-ago summer. The emotions that fostered this embrace of music were not verbal nor a product of thoughts like, "I think I'd like to be a musician." They were prompted by a deeper, more primal process, which I believe Jacques has captured in his descriptions of processes that link brainstem, movement, to limbic, emotional, to cortex, thought. The same could be said for what draws anyone to painting, athletics, poetic rhyming, punning, being a mimic, organizing the furniture, loving paper airplanes, and so forth. Each of these play-based, potentially aesthetic outflows arise from pre-verbal, emotionally inspired variety offered to an open heart ready to play. Another line of thought is that art promotes community integration and interaction. Music, dance, and painting, so often part of harvest festivals and religious observances, bring people together to sing with one voice. Art is part of a deep pre-verbal communication that binds people together. It is literally a communion. This belonging is an outgrowth of early social play among kids. Getting in sync with local groups of kids and being able to follow that lead into more complex communal groups is a necessary ingredient for cohesive community life when conflicts and differences of style and opinion must be hammered out. This applies to families, school boards, church committees, and, unfortunately, to Congress, which appears to have a major play deficiency in this area of socialization. For adults, too, taking part in this play is a way to put us in sync with those around us. It is a way to tap into common emotions and thoughts and share them with others. The Australian director Baz Luhrmann expressed this well when he was instructing drama students in how to perform Shakespeare. His students were speaking their lines flatly, trying too hard to get the words right, and hearing too little of the emotion in the script. In the end, it's called a play because we play, Luhrmann told them. It's a game. It's a big, fun, silly, but profoundly moving human game. We don't participate in community dances much anymore, and our entertainments are often created by multimillionaires who live far away, but the effects of play continue to filter through society and foster community. We follow the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat on ESPN. We experience mafia life with The Sopranos and talk about it with our friends. What about work, which is supposed to be the opposite of play? Is there play in something as serious as biochemical research? After taking play histories of Nobel laureate scientist Roger Guillaume and polio researcher Jonas Salk, I realized that what they were doing every day in the laboratory was playing. When Roger took me through his laboratory, he was like a kid as he described his experiments. Here was the biggest